Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. US President Donald Trump is in town, and India has rolled out the red carpet for him. India has also clearly invested a lot in this relationship with the United States. It's probably one of its most pivotal bilateral ties. But there's always been some misgivings in India about this relationship. Are we drawing too close to the United States? Every time India goes and signs, say, a logistics memorandum of agreement with the United States, some people in India just freak out. And some of these people advocate what they call a multipolar world, a world with multiple powers, each taking care of their own backyard. I have with me today Manoj and Anirudh, and we're going to ask this very basic, simple question. Is a multipolar world good for India? Let's start with you, Manoj. Is it good for India?
So this is, multipolarity is a tenet of Indian foreign policy, a sort of age-old tenet, right? We've been talking about being a power pole since sort of Nehru's times. And therefore, sort of this idea of India must have strategic autonomy and not be dependent. I mean, even in the Cold War, the idea was that you don't get dependent on any one bloc, although effectively we were dependent on the Soviet Union. And subsequently, the idea that when the world was truly unipolar in the 1990s, India faced a lot of pressure from the US, whether it was with regards to human rights, whether it was with regards to nuclear weapons, and so on and so forth. So there was lots of pressure to conform to American sort of values, norms, structures, regimes that were supported by the Americans. And that's begun to change. Increasingly, there is this idea that the world is becoming, if not bipolar, then multipolar. Although we still really don't know where the world is heading. And the idea is that, look, China and the US are two poles right now, but there is the Russians, there is the European Union, there is Turkey, there is Nigeria, there is Brazil. There are so many different countries that could potentially become poles in different parts of the world. And a lot of this has to do with relative American decline. Now, is this good for India? I mean, I guess it depends on when we say good for India. I mean, Indian foreign policy clearly says, the foreign policy thinking, even the Foreign Minister Jaishankar says that multipolarity is something that. But the idea that there would be a prestige in being a pole, maybe. But would it tangibly serve your interests, given that, you know, none of these poles will be equal in weightage? You know, the Chinese are 5 times larger than us. They will remain 5 times larger than us. If even we start to close the gap over the next 20 years, we'll need to grow at a phenomenal pace to seriously close that gap, which is not happening right now. So the differential between the poles will create potential instability. That tells you that it might not necessarily be good for us, because within your backyard, you could get coerced. The sort of converse argument is a unipolar world, therefore good for us. Well, we've been through a unipolar world.
Didn't work out so well.
But in one way, it was good for us, because at least normatively, the idea that, you know, free markets, liberal capitalism, and also a balance of payment crisis forced us to open, you know, our economy, which got us the period of the best growth that we've seen since independence. So, But strategically, it created new problems for us. So there is something in between, or at least there is something about creating your own capacity as opposed to necessarily the nature of the order is what I would sort of say that we should look at. But it's better than unipolarity, but yet the differential will cause us to do different things as opposed to be this. I mean, multipolarity would not inherently mean that all of us are equal. All these sort of power poles are equal.
It seems to me like the biggest problem with India's foreign policy generally has been how disconnected it seems to be from domestic realities. In the sense that, yes, it's all very good to talk about a multipolar world and how that's good for India, but it often doesn't seem to me like foreign policy mandarins understand that politicians are not thinking along the same lines. Right?
Yeah.
And especially with the decline of the liberal international order as spearheaded and maintained by the United States has shown us, it hasn't worked out equally well for all countries, and even within countries hasn't worked out equally well for all people.
Yeah.
India is a really great example. So while Takshashila exists and like we are all here chilling and we're able to sit on Church Street and have very deep conversations about geopolitics and so on and so forth, unemployment still remains a massive, massive issue for most Indians, because the benefits of that growth have not accrued equally to all sections of population. Because of that fact, because of the fact you have unemployment, because you have this economic crisis that politicians don't necessarily have the incentive to solve, you see them essentially taking advantage of the decline of the US to propound values that foreign policy mandarins probably would not be very happy with.
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, the broad point is this, right? There are certain things that the Indian government today is able to do, which it had not been able to do in the 1990s, even if there was will to do it.
Yes.
So let's assume Article 370. Mm. That's the kind of decision that an Indian government would find very difficult to take in a unipolar world dominated by the US, with the idea, with the US sort of with this messianic mission in some ways to sort of shape international regimes in its sort of identity, you know, the idea that universal human rights, you know, humanitarian intervention, these sorts of things. It would have been very difficult for an Indian government to do something like what this government has been doing with regard to Kashmir. But multipolarity, given that it also creates different imperatives for a power like the US, where it needs India to balance China, and India as much sort of needs the US to sort of balance China, creates the room that you can do something like this. And you can have the U.S. ambassador travel as a state guest and come back and say that it was wonderful. Mm. So the allowance increases. Your room for, I mean, that's one example. But your room for maneuver probably increases far more.
That's the crucial point, room for maneuver. Because I think the way that the mandarins have generally been putting it is that India gets more room to maneuver. That is why there is such a whole, that's why there's such a debate about multipolarity and retaining strategic autonomy. Because agreed, yes, at a grand strategy level, India does need room to maneuver. But that, it depends. It really, really matters how that room to maneuver is used.
Yeah.
If that was used, for example, to improve regional connectivity within the Indian Ocean, which is India's backyard, which I think has been an unstated assumption for the foreign policy establishment for the longest time, that would have been great for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But if that room to maneuver is used instead to, you know, violate human rights, if instead of actually building up capabilities to tackle China, you focus on scoring political points at home, then it creates problems.
Yeah, I agree. It creates problems. But I mean, on the connectivity issue, we've also seen that, right? I mean, India has been historically criticized for being poor at delivering promised projects. But now you've got the Japanese working with India. You've got the Americans saying that we want to put some money where our mouth is, because we're not just going to be talking about an Indo-Pacific strategy, but we're going to be putting some money. And at least they've sanctioned some monies and there has been some investments that happened. But there is greater activity. I mean, India's foreign minister recently gave out details of how many projects India is undertaking and how many have been completed at a recent event, at a book launch where he was talking about, and I can't remember the numbers, but it showed that our capacity to complete projects had improved. And a lot of that has to do with India's capacity in itself, but also the fact that you're working with a different set of partners. So you're leveraging different skills and different, you're not just leveraging money, but also different skill sets from different countries. So that is also another thing that it allows you to, that this sort of multipolarity, not just the room for maneuver, but actually deliver and bridge the gaps that you were actually suffering from. That's sort of one thing that, so in that sense, it's good that it creates more options for you. Unipolarity reduces your options. But given the power differential, there's an argument to be made about India possibly bandwagoning with the US, if bandwagoning is something that we can do in that context, to a larger degree than we are currently doing right now. Which, Aditya, as you started by mentioning, this creates a lot of discomfort in some quarters in India. You know, and some people would like to see the heady days of India-China bhai-bhai, which seems quite difficult to achieve. But that's the other option, right? That if the power differential with the Chinese is so large and the threat is so acute, or if at least you start perceiving the threat as so acute, then it might be a case that you need to prolong the power differential between the Chinese and the Americans by bandwagoning to some degree.
You link the multipolar and unipolar worlds to domestic order. So you're talking about how the US, for instance, Manoj, forced India into liberalizing its economy. But what if it's a unipolar world with China? Would that be as conducive to India?
So that's a tricky thing, right? I mean, at the moment, we know this much, that if, let's assume that the United States power sort of dramatically shrinks over the next 10, 15 years, and the Chinese concurrently grow, the linear path of growth continues. And at least if not globally, normatively around Asia, the Chinese emerge as not just the dominant, but the preponderant power. Then you end up in a situation where Chinese values become far more important. Now, my thesis is that the Chinese are unlike the Americans. They don't have, because of the Middle Kingdom exceptionalism that they sort of harbor, the idea that we need to shape countries in our image or we need to shape values in our image doesn't necessarily exist. And the Chinese have sort of been quite clear about that when they say that, yeah, we're not really exporting our model, although somewhere they are exporting their model. But they aren't really saying that you must adopt XYZ kind of governance system. What they're saying is that what you find efficient about what you do and what we can sell, whether it's, you know, digital authoritarianism, whether it's censorship tools and these that, and we'll teach you how to do better censorship, apart from building good roads. And we're happy to do that till we make money off it. But we don't necessarily need you to be a system like ours. Whereas the American approach was that we need you to imbibe the kind of values that we have. So, for example, if you're going into Iraq, if you're going into Afghanistan, the objective, apart from uprooting regimes which are not favorable, is, you know, you need to have women's rights the way we imagine you need to have them. You need to have multi-party systems or whatever else.
You must have democracy, whether or not your history has any experience with democracy.
Exactly.
Whether or not your society has any experience with it, you will have it.
Exactly.
And you will like it.
Exactly. And the Chinese are not telling anybody that you must have strong centralized leadership with provincial leadership, which is sort of whatever. So they're not essentially exporting the system to that degree. So therefore, I don't necessarily see them shaping values in that sense. What I see them bringing is far more flexibility in values, which, again, allows governments in countries which want to be repressive to be repressive till it's okay with Chinese interests. So it would be far more interest-driven than value-driven. Now, a lot of people are very cynical about Americans when they talk about the value system. I'm sure the moment Nitin hears this, he'll tell me values is the faluda that you put on actual interest to make it sound nice. But there is a case to be made that, yes, the Americans have supported the Saudis and the other and other sort of dictatorships, yet there is a case to be made about values as being fundamental to how the US sees the world. The Chinese don't. So I don't think necessarily they will be shaping the international order in that sense. They will be tweaking the international order to suit their interests. That may be inimical to us at certain points of time. So sovereignty might become a value which might be, you know, negotiable if I need to do CPEC. And if I have the power to then coerce India into not bugging me about it, I'll use that. That's how the Chinese would approach it. If I want to make inroads or make a base in Hambantota and India objects, and I have the power to coerce India to not do it, and I have the power to coerce Sri Lanka to hand over its sovereign territory to me, in some sort of an unequal treaty, I will do it. So the normatively, that may sort of change. One could argue that the Americans have also done this, but they've done this with a slightly more, so it's slightly more sophistication and polish. The Chinese might not do it with that sort of sophistication and polish. And the sophistication polish essentially shames normative architecture. I don't think the Chinese will do that. To me, they might undermine certain norms. But I don't think they will want to shape countries in their own image. I don't think that's that would just defy this idea of Middle Kingdom exceptionalism, the inner subjects, the outer subjects, and barbarians. Why would you want to civilize barbarians?
They find themselves in opposition to other countries. And if there are, it's better to be surrounded by failing democracies and say, look at these barbarians and look how much more civilized we are. Look how much better our party state is. We are superior and we shall make money off of them.
Yeah, but you also want some of these countries to make money and so on. So you want reasonably stable governments. And sometimes I'm sure you'll have regime preference. And those preferences may not be necessarily the most liberal democratic ones.
What the Chinese have shown us so far is that they will work with any government. Whether it is Yameen in the Maldives or the current leadership, Sole, or whether it's Rajapaksa or Sirisena, whether it's Hasina or Khaleda Zia, whoever it is, they
whoever
will work
does
with
their bidding.
Yeah, I mean, they'll work with them. And, you know, whether it's the confrontational communist government of Vietnam, or whether it is, you know, Shinzo Abe, nationalistic Shinzo Abe in Japan, they'll work with whoever. Will they have frictions from time to time? Of course, yes. And they will use tools to make sure, their instruments that they can to make sure that they get things. So that's what I'm saying, that certain norms may get undermined because they will be far more willing to weaponize other instruments, economics for one. But that's already happening. I mean, the Americans, as part of the trade war, and today you'll hear a lot of people from the US criticizing the fact that we didn't launch this trade war or technology war or this decoupling. I mean, and you'll get a list of American tech companies which are banned in China, starting from Google, Facebook, and the rest of them. Saying that, well, this is when decoupling began. The Chinese began it. We've just sort of ramped it up. But the fact is that acceptance by American governments of this posture by the Chinese normalized it. Today, when the Americans have started to say, well, okay, you export so much to me, I'm going to add tariffs and I'm going to block, put you on the entity list and this and that. You have weaponized economics. The Chinese know that well. They've done that well. And you will see more of that. That will mean that order breaks down. because there's a shared set of rules which sort of break down. Therefore, multipolarity may bring much more instability. If the Chinese are unipolar, they'll organize their own order, but their own order might not be universally applicable to all. There will be far more flexibility in that order to suit Chinese interests. You know, I don't think there will be values by which the Chinese will say, look, these are the kind of values that we need to have. And these values may also constrain us. So, for example, the US can lose WTO cases. I don't think the Chinese in a Sino-centric world order will be open to losing such international cases. Chinese judicial system does not sort of tell us that they will be open to such sort of rule of law scrutiny. So I think that is the difference. And that's why I say values will matter.
And that's a very interesting point, because I'm just thinking broadly in terms of the way that the global economic system works now. It works on a system of trust.
Yeah.
The idea that, okay, so my default stance of the country is that I can expect the rule of law to apply. I can expect that if this country treats my exports arbitrarily, then I can drag it to the WTO for impartial adjudication. Mm. But in a world that China dominates, you don't know if you can really trust that anymore.
Yeah.
So it becomes all of a sudden far more important to cultivate China than it ever was to cultivate the US.
Yeah. Yeah.
You cannot trust that global institutions will run according to an impartial framework.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I would also expect there to be a lot more friction between countries within the global economic system, which in the long term would lead to essentially economic fragmentation and essentially bubbles forming within the global economy.
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea, right? Multipolarity may end you in a position where there are spheres of influence.
I mean, I think that's very much the idea that the Russians and the Chinese have.
Yeah.
I don't think they make any bones about it.
Yeah.
They are talking about spheres of influence.
They are talking about spheres of influence. I mean, and I was reading recently, there was a paper last year by John Mearsheimer in which he talked about the fact that, well, we'd already entered multipolarity by 2012, if I'm correct. And however he defined it, I can't remember how he defined it. And this was the broad takeaway. He said that going forward, what you're going to see is bounded orders, bounded multipolar orders led by the Chinese and their allies and the Americans and their allies. I found the Chinese and their allies a bit slightly surprising, because I can't see who are China's allies. Apart from maybe if you want to count Russia and Pakistan as allies, I can't see who allies are. But maybe he meant allies a little bit more loosely.
The mighty state of Laos.
So that's so mean. But I think, yeah.
Sorry, Laos.
Yeah, we really love you. Free visas, please.
So there are broadly three types of orders, say unipolar, bipolar, and multipolar orders. And let's just look back at the experience of multipolar orders for a second. Because I think if we look at it from India's perspective, it really isn't all that great. Proponents of multipolar orders basically talk about the era from 1815 to 1914, this whole century of peace in Europe, not necessarily elsewhere, where the European colonial powers were having a good time, but in Europe. So this is after French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. You had the Congress of Vienna, basically a big peace deal in 1815. And you had something called the Concert of Europe. And what this Concert of Europe was basically a sort of vague commitment to maintain the status quo. No more territorial aggrandizement, no more interference in each other's internal affairs. And our biggest challenge now is revolutions from within. Now, the revolutions from within happened 1830, 32, the biggest one in 1848. And so this order basically came to an end. And then you had a period of adjustment from about 1848 to 1870. And that's, of course, the period of Germany's rise.
Yep.
And then you had Germany's rise really going unchallenged until 1914, the outbreak of the First World War. Now, you wonder, why did Germany manage to rise? Why didn't other countries balance against it? If you look at that 100-year period, there's really two countries that have arisen. You have Germany and the United States. And both of them seem to have got scot-free until 1914. And America basically got scot-free. So how did this happen? And I think a lot of the answer is that this was a multipolar world. In 1871, after the Franco-Prussian War, you know, Germany was on top. And what Otto von Bismarck, the German leader, could do thereafter was basically balance off all these powers against each other. So there were always some crises or the other in Europe. So if you were France, Germany was your big concern, but it was not necessarily your only concern. This is a system in which you had the French, the Germans, the Russians, the Ottomans, the Austrians, and the British. And all of these powers were forming ad hoc groupings to balance off each other. And there were always some crisis or the other. And so there was always ways to appeal to short-term interests. For instance, the Germans could be very supportive of French colonialism abroad after their war with them in 1870-71, and in exchange, do whatever else they wanted in Europe. And so this basically created a very conducive environment for Germany's rise. It's just that that system became so complicated by the 1890s, and you know, you didn't have a steady hand at the helm, and that sort of made Germany become more abrasive over the next couple of decades, and then eventually you had a war. Case of the United States is even more interesting, because who's the status quo power in, say, 1880? It was Great Britain.
Mm.
And to Great Britain, its great challenger is actually the United States. The United States is basically enforcing the Monroe Doctrine, which meant
sees the Americas as its sphere of influence.
As its own sphere of influence. And it's basically kicking the British out of everywhere.
Hmm.
It's kicking the British out of everything from Venezuela to Canada, its own dominion.
Hmm.
And yet at the same time, the British don't necessarily go and balance against these guys because they have other interests. The British are worried about the Germans.
Hmm.
And the British also, here's where regime type matters. The British know that the Americans are a lesser threat than other European powers. Let's say if, you know, the 1898 Spanish-American War, the Americans go and basically take over the Philippines.
Yeah.
Now, the British are not so sad about that because they have a very similar commitment or idea about free trade.
Yeah.
And so the British know that those markets will be open to them. Whereas if those markets had gone to this, had remained with the Spanish or, for heaven's sake, had gone to the Germans, that market would be closed to them.
Yeah.
So the regime type matters. As of course, you know, the common language and ethnicity and all that. Basically, there was no balancing against the United States. And that's really, the United States, the superpower of today, is really a product of that multipolar world.
Hmm.
So if we think that multipolar worlds can't beget superpowers in the future, I think we should just step back and take a look at what happened here. Now, some people might say, look, you had 100 years of peace. That's great.
Yeah, 100 years of peace in Europe?
In Europe, yeah. So that's all we're talking about right now.
Wait, I'm just trying to, I mean, the imagination obviously fails, but if you kind of extrapolate this to an entire world, the entire planet that's covered in these constantly shifting webs of alliances and balancing, counterbalancing, conflicting ideas of how trade, economics should work, different threat perceptions, different threat environments in different parts of the world, depending on a country's ability to project power, it doesn't seem like a very peaceful world to me. In fact, it seems like a recipe for all the more chaos.
It's a world in which you didn't have major great power war. It's as simple as that.
It's a Europe in which you don't have major great power wars.
And those are all the great powers besides the United States.
Mm.
Okay, so some people make the argument that you had 100 years of peace.
Mm.
But during that 100 years of peace, look at where Germany and the United States were. Prussia was a tiny kingdom recovering from a war and an occupation by France. The United States was a crazy experiment in a republican democracy.
Yeah.
And it was a completely agrarian economy, it was mostly 13 colonies. The idea that these would become superpowers would have seemed absurd in 1815.
Hmm.
China today is not in that position. China has already risen to a great extent. So it's more akin to, say, Germany in 1871. Now, if you start a multipolar order at that period of time, you're basically creating an environment that's very conducive to China's rise.
Yeah.
And to my mind, that is not necessarily in India's interests.
So you mean to say if we have a multipolar order at this point of time, you are aiding China's rise? I mean, when you were talking about this, the history, it gave me a sense that why would a non-controversial India, imagine India as the United States of the 1800s, okay? Although very different geographies, very, very different contested geographies. But India is the United States of the 1800s, and the United States is the Great Britain of that time, and China as the Germany, which is threatening whatever. The friction that the US and Germany could potentially see, in many ways, India is not a threat to the US at all. At present, and even potentially future, India is not a threat. You know, there is a value congruence broadly, however those might shift based on government to government. India is generally, at least since the 1990s, we've had this sense that we will be moving towards freer market. And there is a, if not government policy today, there is at least a large constituency in India which wants free markets, and there is a robust democracy where at least you can push back on ideas. How successful those pushbacks are is a different matter altogether. And let's not rate it by, you know, one or two governments, however long those governments might last. If the long-term trend can be looked at and said that, if we can argue, you know, assumptions to this argument, is that India will move in that direction. There is space for us to sort sort of keep a head down as capacity increases, impose your sort of sphere of influence without necessarily threatening the great power that you're yourself most akin to, which is the US, and let them contain the Chinese. Let them compete and contain the Chinese. I mean, that's a good space for us to be in, rather than wondering that, oh my God, these Americans, you know, we need to be very careful of them, and we need to be careful and watchful of everybody. The multipolarity in that sense might be useful for us, right?
Okay, so I think that there's quite a few points I want to raise here. The first, I think, is, of course, a declining empire is usually never interested in a great power competition, from what I can see. I don't think Britain in the 19th century wanted to cut Prussia down to size. Whether it could have done realistically is another matter. But it just had too many other commitments, too many other things, that dissipating its political energy everywhere. And I don't see how Britain would have taken it on, frankly speaking. Especially considering that Germany, through this entire period, continued to be one of Britain's major trade partners. Which I think is another aspect of the US-China relationship, right? So I don't see that will from the US to take China on. First point. Second, where is India's Monroe Doctrine? The US at least had a game plan. The US knew it wanted to modernize. It was building railroads across the entire continent. It was, well, you know, doing what it was doing to Native Americans. But it was investing in building up its power. India is not doing that. So while I understand how the analogy might make sense, I would say that I'd like to actually take us even further back to yet another historical analogy. I think this is sort of like a Peloponnesian War scenario. Think of the US as Athens, this enormously wealthy superpower that has political legitimacy, that has buy-in from a very, very large number of states. You have China, which is far more militarized, basically like Sparta, and which is extremely uncomfortable about American influence in its near abroad. Tensions are rising between them. I don't think the Americans are anywhere near as belligerent as the Athenians were, or anywhere near as, I mean, definitely as arrogant as the Athenians, but whether they're willing to go to war is another matter entirely. And what is India in the picture? I mean, India should be aiming to be the Macedonia that comes and cleans up after these guys have gone to war.
That should be ideally the thing, right?
That should be the goal.
Get involved.
Well, yeah, I agree with the goal. conquering the world. I think what you both have perfectly described are bipolar orders. Where you have basically two major powers facing off against each other. But the problem with a multipolar world would be, for instance, having a resurgent Russia, a powerful China, and the United States. And having these countries in shifting allegiances. So, for instance, currently the United States has a difficult relationship with both Russia and China. That is the sort of thing, Anirudh, that dissipates its energy. On the other hand, if it really only had China to worry about, and it was not so focused, say, on the Middle East, it would be able to balance against China much more effectively. It would certainly be more committed to the challenge. Same with the Peloponnesian War. I think that with a multipolar world, India is simply not going to find as reliable a partner, as focused a partner, to take on a long-term challenge. You talked about Britain. That's exactly what happened with Britain. Britain, of course, had its own imperial commitments. But besides the imperial commitments, of course, it was also looking, it was also worried about the Russians. It was also worried about the Americans. So that multipolar world actually lends itself to the rise of power. So, you know, at that moment when India is a significant pole by itself, a multipolar world might
it's
work for it.
Absolutely great for us, yeah.
But at this point, when, let's be frank, we're not a pole. We're not superpower 2020. It's already 2020. Look at your watches. It's not really very good for us.
Yeah, I mean, we're not where we should have been. And we're not even at the moment in a position where we are primed to go where we should be going. And a lot of that has to do with the economy. Our economy, when you don't grow at a certain pace that you should, that your potential should be. The fact that even today, I mean, I used to be a young man when people used to say India is an emerging power. I am now well past middle-aged and people are still saying we're an emerging power. So, and that's a little disappointing.
Well, I'm pretty sure that the same will hold true for me as well.
So, I think that is the challenge that we need to... I mean, I hope it doesn't happen to you. And by the time you are, you know, middle-aged, it's like... Okay, we were right. We're at least a pole, if not the tallest pole. We're at least a pole which is effective in some which way. It's no longer potential, but actually potential that's been realized to a large degree. I think that would be the important thing. But yeah, I mean, broadly on multipolarity, there is, I think it's important to keep in mind that it might not be an end in itself for us. Yeah. Although a lot of our foreign policy seems to always suggest that that is an end in itself.
You can't.
And like Aditya pointed out, right, multipolarity will eventually, I mean, orders will shift and there will be great or greater powers emerging from a multipolar world, which will cause more problems or more challenges going forward.
Multipolarity is not a mantra to increase India's influence on the global stage. You cannot disconnect multipolarity from domestic political incentives. And most importantly, you cannot disconnect it from realities of the international environment. I think that anyone who blindly insists that multipolarity is great for India could do with a nice splash of cold water on their faces and take a look at China looming into our near neighborhood. And I do not see any other superpower, even the US, extending its influence into the Indian Ocean in the immediate future other than China.
Yeah.
All right. It's been a really great episode. We've gone from unipolarity of opinions to a bipolarity to a multipolarity and back to a unipolarity.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Anirudh. Thank you, Manoj.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you for joining us on All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst. Or our website, takshashila.org.in.